Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. To call these unsettling times is an understatement. Our political leaders are less and less respectable. In the realm of business, cheating, lying, and stealing are hazily defined. And in daily life, rapidly changing technology offers permission to act in ways inconceivable. Yet, somehow, this hasn't quite led to a complete free-for-all. People still draw lines around what is acceptable and what is not. In her new book, Eden Collinsworth explores all of these issues. We welcome Eden Collinsworth. She is a former media executive and business consultant. She was president of Arbor House Publishing Company and founder of the Los Angeles-based monthly lifestyle magazine Buzz, before becoming a vice president at Hearst Corporation. She served as the chief of staff at the East-West Institute, a global think tank. In 2011, after writing a best-selling book in China for Chinese business people on Western deportment, she launched Collinsworth & Associates, a Beijing-based consulting company which specialized in intercultural communication. The author of I Stand Corrected, How Teaching Western Manners in China Became Its Own Unforgettable Lesson. She currently lives in London, and we are speaking to her in London. So we welcome to Common Threads, Eden Collinsworth. Hello, Eden.
How do you do? Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. What was the main impetus for writing this particular book? Was it just dealing with people as they are?
Actually, the preamble to this book was my living in China for the period of a year among Chinese. So I had been in and out of China for the better part of 30 years, but it was very much as a Westerner coming through, as opposed to somebody who was actually living there. And it became very apparent to me quickly that I was operating with a set of moral values that were simply not shared. And so it occurred to me further that, you know, if you look at the population of China, it's one in every five people on the planet, and that the fact that this vast number of people were operating from a different moral reference point was, initially disconcerting, but then actually I got quite interested in whether or not my own moral values were germane in America, my own country as well. So that's what prompted me to go looking for whether or not there is a future for morality now anywhere.
A lot of people, particularly on the more conservative end of the spectrum, talk about moral relativism. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Well, in fact, that is precisely what was disconcerting to me in China, because the Chinese are not operating from what the Westerners would consider a Judeo-Christian sense of right and wrong or fairness, what is fair or not fair. They're operating with a far more kind of atmospheric sense, philosophical sense, which is Confucian-based. And they believe that there are many, many ways of being right and very few ways of being wrong. And it's predominantly kind of circumstantial. And so if you were dealing with something as fundamental as a business contract, for example, in the West, that's thought of as the culmination of a dialogue that's occurred. And, you know, you've agreed to various terms that have been outlined. And that's that. You know, in China, often is the case where they believe that a contract is the continuation of that dialogue. And so they operate in, I suppose, what the Westerners would consider a gray area. There is very little black and white. And that, I think, is, you know, one way, certainly, of defining moral relativism.
Certainly, we've interviewed many people of a variety of Eastern religions, and this idea of non-binary philosophy is a common thread throughout them. Confucianism, Buddhism, mm-hmm. Hinduism, and when you look at Western society, yeah, there is more of a binary philosophy in the theology, and I think that works its way into the workaday world. You tell a fascinating story about Japan. So I'm assuming that what you talk about China is shared to some degree in Japan. You talk about the Westerner who was made, I believe, CEO of a company.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well, I think perhaps it might be helpful first to define morality versus ethics. So morality is a personal set of beliefs, and ethics is expressed in the expectations and by way of sanctions that are defined and enforced by a given culture or society in a given period of time. And so there are societal expectations, which in fact are expressed by ethical standards. And it happened that in this particular case, this man was a whistleblower for his own company, and he was a British businessman who had been at Olympus, which is one of the largest Japanese companies and perhaps even one of the largest international companies. He had been there for some 30 years and was promoted to become its CEO, which is unusual to have a Westerner running a Japanese company. But I think the board felt that there was need for very fundamental changes, and it was easier actually to enlist an outsider. The point is that shortly after he assumed that role, he had access to financials he wouldn't otherwise have had, and it was horrifyingly clear to him that there was malfeasance that had been passed along in the form of bookkeeping from one CEO to the other. I think it, in fact, it was like a baton that was passed to three separate CEOs. And the point is that as long as it wasn't reconciled on the books, it could be ignored or not made public. And he felt that the transparent thing to do, the right thing to do, was to address it and correct it. And he went to the board, and they promptly fired him. And on the one hand, from a Western perspective, he did absolutely the right thing. From the perspective of the Japanese, in fact, he did the wrong thing, because they are loyal to the company more than any one thing. In fact, when he went public, he had to turn to the Financial Times and not a Japanese publication, because they're very protective of their corporations. And the point is that by going public, the stock price plummeted, and they had to let hundreds of people go. They lost their jobs, obviously. And so he was vilified for having made that decision. And there is actually a very good example of how ethics and vary according to the culture and the set of circumstances.
And what ultimately happened to him, do you know?
Yes, I do. He actually it took a period of time, but he was awarded a certain amount of, I guess it was it made up for the fact that he lost income. And so I think he was awarded a wrongful firing amount, which was substantial. And he's funneled that into a charity or a variety of charities. It happened also that eventually, not right away, but eventually the chairman of the company was actually incarcerated for his role, so that it took a long period of time, but ultimately it righted itself. However, it didn't make up for the fact that there were people who lost their jobs. And so, again, everything is relative in terms of the right and wrong.
Now, you mentioned in the book, you yourself are not religious. You pay homage to the fact that many people do get their ethics and morality out of religious traditions. I'm curious, mm-hmm. Were you raised in a particular tradition?
I wasn't. My mother was European, and my father was an American from the South. And they both were incredibly correct and strict. And so at no point was there any misunderstanding as to what right and wrong was. In fact, I think perhaps they might have been, a parent myself, now looking back, I realized that they were perhaps too strict. But the fact is that they were utterly principled people, and they grew up with very clear rules of moral behavior. In other words, there was no moral relativism. It was made very clear. That was also a period of time where that was called for, or in fact, there was no. I mean, there were not the profound changes that have occurred in the last 20 years. A great deal of which has to do with technology. And so, I was raised by parents who instilled in me moral values. My son, who's now in his 20s, I consider him utterly decent. But I suspect that what has shaped his moral perspective, more so than, you know, parental influence, have been these changes that have occurred. He grew up with the internet. He didn't grow up with social media, and even that is an interesting demarcation in terms of a different perspective. But you know, it's a very, very different time, and so from a business perspective, if you wanted to, you know, become fairly granular about it. My father was a businessman. He was a successful businessman, but he believed that his handshake was his word, and his word was a bond. And I don't know quite honestly whether that perspective would be at all applicable today, when that is not necessarily the case. People break contracts all the time. Certainly their handshake is not necessarily their bond. And nor is it expected to be. So the point is that in his time, his extreme moral sense of right and wrong didn't prevent him from becoming a successful businessman. I don't know whether it would broker him any favors today.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and joining me today is Eden Collinsworth. She is the author of Behaving Badly: The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. Eden, yes, let's talk about technology, because you do spend a little bit of ink, more than a little bit of ink, mm-hmm. on that subject. What do you think are the most important points in the last few years? What has changed technologically and in the world of morals?
Well, it's affected every aspect of our lives. And so it's not at all unusual today for someone to be spending 9 hours during his or her waking day on media in front of a screen. And so one of the people I interviewed was this rather formidable neuroscientist here in the UK. She had made it very clear she wasn't passing judgment. She wasn't suggesting that someone is less moral as a result. But she's very matter-of-factly put across the fact that her you know, research, that the brain functions limit themselves to fewer dimensions when what you have, you know, is 9 hours of screen time, and basically the brain is a highly sensitive organism that is constantly evolving. And so, for example, the frontal lobes, which in fact have evolved the most in the last 500 years and have physically grown, speak very specifically to a variety of tasks. One is organization, the other is putting things in perspectives. And also housed in that area of the brain is the ability to become empathetic, and that I believe that you're not necessarily born empathetic, but in fact that is a skill or a skill set that you acquire, and it's more challenging to acquire that when in fact you're not speaking to somebody face to face. And what you're seeing more and more is even with the telephones, and you can, if you hear somebody, you can, you know, you can somehow feel slightly more comfortable about reading the tone of their voice. You can even perhaps be alert to the silences between the words. But now telephones are used more and more, not for speaking, but in fact for conveying text messages. So all of these, you know, this technology removes us from human interaction on a daily basis. And that, I think, makes it more challenging to develop these skills. So that's certainly one way. I also focused on morality and money, and unfortunately, we don't behave very well around money. it just is that simple. I mean, the research, underscores the fact that we're more likely to be sympathetic or altruistic or empathetic if it doesn't cost us anything. And so if you think of what technology has, how technology has changed the manner in which money is being made, that really is quite profound. So it used to be that money was the measurement of service and goods, and now because of technology, technology that most of us don't have access to, and certainly almost all of us can't begin to understand, there is the making of money from money in nanoseconds. And that has resulted in these vast gaps of wealth between people who have made money from money or technology and those who are still operating with the kind of old business model. So all of this impacts our daily lives, and that and begins to shape a different kind of morality.
Yeah, I one time spoke to a cousin who was involved in a business that made money with money, and mm-hmm. We asked him one time what he did, and he says, "I shuffle papers around."
I think that's probably right. Now I would suggest that he probably, there are no papers to shuffle around. It's all on a screen, and it happens very quickly, and a lot of it happens literally as a result of algorithms that are projecting, trends. I mean, the equity market really is not necessarily reflecting the performance of a company. It's anticipating the emotion of reaction to news. And so all of that is now, can be picked up by computers that then project whether the market, whether it's time to buy or sell. And, it's just an entirely different environment.
I would imagine as well that businesses today are looking for short-term gains as opposed to long-term. And yes. I can only imagine that affects the ethos of a company and the ethical or moral complexion of a company to know that, okay, all we have to do is massage whatever we need to massage to get a good quarterly report. Forget about what we're going to do 10 years down the road or even a year down the road.
I think that's absolutely correct. And on the immediate front, I mean, what you have seen repeatedly are companies that, I mean, in the most cynical way, are literally figuring in the fees that are levied against them for malfeasance. They figure that into their profit and loss, in other words, their projections, and they weigh financially whether or not it's worth acting in ways that, in fact, are certainly incorrect and almost always immoral. And that, I think, is frankly the only thing that will address that is to put people in jail and not fine them. And so I'm somebody who, frankly, under various circumstances, promotes punishment as opposed to levying fines. Punishment that involved jail time.
That came up in the recent presidential campaign. The idea of actually putting executives in prison for mm-hmm. malfeasance didn't get anywhere. I know we're not there right now.
Well, that's true. And I must say that I don't, in the UK, that, hundreds of millions of pounds and dollars have been paid out from banks. And there have been very few bankers going to jail, and that is certainly the case in America. And so, the question is, is that moral? I don't believe it is.
Do you know of any countries in Europe where they would take that stand collectively, that people at the top need to know that their freedom is at risk for malfeasance.
Well, I think that it's becoming more and more the case in Europe and the UK. I mean, if you wanted to point to an extreme example, you know, the year that I lived in China, you know, there was the scandal of tainting the powdered milk. And I, frankly, the Chinese have a very direct way of handling it. The CEO was executed the next morning. So that's certainly one way of dealing with issues. You know, it doesn't involve any lawyers, by the way.
That's probably not going to happen anytime soon here.
No. But that, and as I said, that's an extreme example. But I think that, you know, I think you, if you look at the automobile scandal and the Panama Papers, what you see is a range of, it's not siloed in one country. So if you look at, you know, the companies that were cheating in terms of the admission reports and standards, you know, it was not only the Germans, but the Japanese, the Americans. So the point is that around money, especially, people will be people, you know, for right or wrong, they will behave, you know, in a very similar and human way. And so my sense is that the only way to deter is not necessarily to appeal to somebody's sense of morality, because they've already behaved that way, but to punish them by sending them off to jail. That's something that perhaps they will understand.
Yeah, clearly. What about manners? Would you agree that our everyday manners, in a way, reflects our sense of morality or our sense of ethics?
Well, I think that's right. And my mother, who was European and very kind of old guard, you know, made it very clear to me as a little girl that she believed that civility forged a path towards moral behavior and habit and, you know, decency, all of those, you know, kind of the nitty-gritty that comes into play. And I think that that's correct. But again, if you consider technology, I mean, you take Twitter as an example, and I'm the first to admit I now have a Twitter account and a Facebook account because my publisher insisted that I had to. I really didn't have a choice in the matter, and so I have very gingerly kind of wandered into all of this. But if you look at this as a platform, Twitter, it offers, I think it's something like 300 million monthly active users the opportunity to either enthuse endorsements or really hurl insults at 140 characters at a time. And there is absolutely no need to see or hear the effect that either has on the receiving end. And you see this more and more. When I was speaking to the neuroscientist here in the UK, what she was suggesting to revisit the idea that you don't have, you know, what you lack on the screen is an in-person, you know, dialogue. You don't have that. And so what happens very quickly is that the vernacular ratchets into something rather more abrupt. And so this is why, you know, very quickly, arguments where you don't necessarily share somebody's perspective moves into a rudeness at the very least, and then kind of vitriolic, you know, sometimes hate at its worst. And I think that I don't think that you would necessarily tweet what you would say in person.
If you just joined Facebook, be grateful that you've joined after the campaign season of the last couple of years.
Oh God, it's really. But yes, well, even now, what you realize is you are operating within a bubble. So here, you know, I was asked to basically identify friends, which is a fairly loose interpretation of what friends actually are.
Yes,
and the point is that I am the first to admit that I have, you know, operated in
bubbles. I mean, I've lived in international cities. People who live in cities are likely to hew to like-minded people who, you know, are operating either in their professional or social orbit. And so, you know, my opinion should be certainly considered first and foremost by that fact. And, you know, it's the adage of consider the source. And so what you don't get, or it's unlikely you're going to get on Facebook or any, frankly, social media hub, is a variety of perspectives and viewpoints. You are probably going to operate within that continuation of that loop and that bubble.
Eden, we are out of time for this episode of Common Threads, but this is a great conversation. We haven't even really gotten into politics yet, so I'm hoping you'll be able to join us next week and we can move on from here.
Yes, I will. I look forward to that.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today, Eden Collinsworth. She is the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. Please join us again next week right here on WGVU.